We gather to seek, to find, and to share the promise of honest religion.
To come alive, to see truth, and to heal our world.
And so it is a sacred time, this, and a sacred place, this.
A place for questions more profound than answers.
Vulnerability more powerful than strength.
And the peace that can pass all understanding.
It is a sacred time, this. Let us begin it together in song. Candles through some beautiful choral music, through prayer and silence, we can get in touch with and dwell in our centers. You may use these first moments for lighting candles or just sitting quietly, remembering who you are and why you are here. Please join with me in a spirit of prayer. When people or experiences become doorways or windows, let us learn to look through them. When someone or something in life opens us to the possibility of a life with more understanding, compassion, or wholeness, let us gather our courage and step through that opening from the world of the habitual into a world of the possible. When we feel the pull of authenticity, let us bend toward it, that it may pull us into lives of greater integrity, love, and joy. Life is a series of pushes and pulls, too many trying to push us toward selling out, toward settling for too little from ourselves, pushing us toward the dissipation of our spirits. But not all of life is against us. If it is true that we live among angels and demons and have been frightened by the demons, let us remember there are angels as well, messengers from life, from places of trust, empowerment, from a healing kind of truth and hope. Those angels, let us walk with those angels in whatever guise they appear. Sometimes they even appear among those who love us. We hunger for messages of wholeness and hope. Let us listen for them, answer them, and be prepared to be transformed. Amen. I want to spend some time this fall making us more aware of the rich history of honest religion. By honest religion, I mean a religion that is open to all critical questions, to all doubts, and whose truths have to be grounded in life itself, not merely the dogmas, habits, and ideologies of this or that church. Last month, I talked about that spirit in the story of Gilgamesh, which is the world's oldest story, going back 4,700 years. You can find it in all times and places. Today I want to jump 4,500 years from last time and talk about Reverend William Ellery Channing. Most of you may never have heard of him, but he was the man most responsible for making Unitarianism into a separate American faith nearly 200 years ago. He did it through a very influential sermon he preached in 1819. The title of the sermon was Unitarian Christianity. It's ironic that the seeds that he planted in that sermon were neither Unitarian nor Christian, though they were important seeds and far older than merely 200 years ago, as you'll hear. Now, I think it's always tricky looking back in history to someone who was fairly gifted or great, especially if they happen to share some connection with the label that we also like to wear. It can border on the worst kind of narcissism. Well, he was Unitarian and he was spectacular, and I'm Unitarian too. So it's kind of like wearing a Longhorns t-shirt and then thinking that you must be a nationally ranked athlete. Now, I'm aware of this one because I have a Longhorns t-shirt that I wear to the gym, but I'm a rank athlete, not a ranked one. And there's quite a difference there. So a different approach to history, gifted thinkers, is to say, here was somebody faced with the same kinds of life's questions that also face me. And this person found a way to look beyond the habits of their time and the thoughts of the people around them and to respond to them by tapping into something timeless and life-giving. Now, that's breathtaking. I want that too, so maybe I can learn something from them. That's the approach that I want to take here. So I wouldn't care whether this man were a Unitarian or a Quadratarian or any other kind of Tarian. I just care that he was able to open a door and open a window into something that can feed every one of us. So I want to start by backing off and describing a little more about what this spirit of honest religion is about, so that we can see this William Ellery Channing fellow in the right context and see how what he did might be useful to you in your lives. Otherwise, there's no reason to hear about him at all. You can just turn on the Discovery Channel and hear about people you never heard about before. There are a lot of ironies in studying him. Some historians have said that it's too bad that American Unitarianism was ever called Unitarian because it's the wrong name. And I agree with them. It is the wrong name. Unitarian was the insult name that was assigned to it by those who hated it and attacked it, especially in the 1820s and 30s. But it was never about how many gods we're supposed to count. Nor was it really about a set of beliefs. Unitarianism was about a style of approaching religion, a style of seeking honest religion. And it was the same style, and I can prove this to you over and over and over again, it's the same style that you can find in all times and places, in all religions, whenever this liberal spirit appears. There are many ways to put this notion of a primal spirit of religion. One is to say that it's about coming alive, seeking the truth and healing our world. It's hard to think of any religion on earth that wouldn't affirm those three things. Another is summed up in 10 words from the Christian scriptures that have become favorite words of mine since I found them in a translation where they're more clear. In old translations, the first three words were prove all things, and I never understood what that meant. In the New American Standard Bible, they finally translated into very simple and clear words. Here are the 10 words. Examine everything carefully. Hold fast to that which is good. I challenge you to find people who don't believe that. And if they aren't acting on it, who aren't ashamed that they aren't acting on it. Examine everything carefully. Hold fast to that which is good. Those 10 words, if you think about it, are also a very good summary of the scientific method. Examine everything carefully. Maybe it has more of a scowl when you do it that way. Hold fast only to that which is good. But then you examine that too. Then you hold fast. But it's also how we all act, isn't it? This is what we all want to do with our lives. We always want to. I don't care what it is. It's a new job offer. It's a new relationship. It's whatever it is. We want to examine everything carefully. And then we want to find what's good and feels life-giving, and that's what we want to hold fast to. This comes from the human spirit. This doesn't come from a religion or a church. This is as deep and as basic as anything there is. This is the soul of honest religion in all times and places. Now, in every flowering that I know of this spirit of honest religion, there is a trinity involved. And that trinity is there in the Unitarianism of William Ellery Channing, too, which is another reason that it's too bad it was ever called Unitarian. But it's a very different kind of trinity. This is sort of a trinity that's a gift to established religions the way the Trojan horse was a gift to the people of Troy. It has within it three things that will destroy any orthodoxy, any creed, and any boundaries that would fence the spirit. It is a spirit of revolution in thought and in belief wherever it occurs. You'll recognize this. The first leg of this trinity is grounded in our experience here and now. In other words, religion has to relate to you and your actual life, or it can't be your religion. If it's just teachings about somebody else's life, somebody else's belief, then you will be living somebody else's life if you buy it. And that won't leave anyone to live your life. Religion has to be grounded in your experience and your life. That's the first part of the Trinity. The second part of honest religion's Trinity is that our reasoning and our intuition are things we need to trust. In fact, we do trust them, but we may trust them. And no religious teaching should ever be accepted if it doesn't make sense to us. Now, maybe in 10 years, we'll revisit it from a different place and it'll make sense. Fine, then accept it. Don't accept it until then. The fact that it makes sense to someone else with a loud voice doesn't count. There is a kind of mysticism about this that's really kind of surprising. It's the same mysticism that also exists in science. Scientists hate to hear that because they've been taught that they're too proud to be mystical. But it's profoundly mystical. Here's the mysticism. We believe, and I'm guessing everyone in the room believes, we believe that there is some kind of a unity, an identity, because what between what we honestly, deeply think and feel, and the world out there. If we didn't believe that, we couldn't do science. If we didn't believe that, we couldn't trust relationships. We couldn't trust much of anything if we didn't think that our honest thoughts and feelings, our reason, our intuition, didn't have something to do with the world that's actually out there. That's the second leg of this trinity behind the method of honest religion, wherever you find it. These are revolutionary things. Think about them. So far, you can shatter every orthodoxy in the world with this, just these two. The third now is what makes it religious. And this, too, is true of every religion I know of. And that's that what we're looking for... If we stop at the first two, all we have is militant narcissism. I mean, think about it. You know, the world is as I think it is, for I think it is that way. But enough about me. What do you think of me? I mean, it gets dreary before the end of the sentence. It's the third leg of this that makes it religious and that makes it profound and that makes it life-giving. The third leg of the method is that we honestly believe we need to find a center, a focus, a God, if you like, something that we can put at the center of our life, that we can serve with our life, and that will give us life. Now, this has gone under many, many different names, and they're not the same. Buddhists may say that this center is simply waking up to the fact that we mostly live in illusions, that the world doesn't fit our illusions, and that we can have a real kind of happiness if we'll wake up and live in the real world. That's one whole path. Confucius ignored all the gods and said, look, the quality of our happiness in life comes primarily from our interactions with others. So what we need to learn is how to interact with others smoothly and gracefully and caringly. Not bad. Lao Tzu pretty much ignored all the gods too in his Tao Te Ching. But he said, there's a style to life. There's a style to the powers of the universe. There's a way things work. And we need to be aware of it and become a part of it. Now that's non-theistic, but it's absolutely religious. Or the Buddhist can say, in each of us there is a Buddha seed, and we need to recognize and nourish that Buddha seed that we too may grow into our Buddhahood. This is all love talk. You can hear that. It's all love talk. It's part of what makes it so powerful. Christian thinkers like Meister Eckhart in the Middle Ages said, well, and I don't think he knew about the Buddha seed thing. He said, there's a God seed inside of us. Maybe he plagiarized. I don't think so. I think that people who live there can recognize it, and it's not surprising to describe it in very similar ways. There's a God seed inside of us, Eckhart said, and we need to nourish that. If you don't like that kind of poetry, just say, I am looking for high and true and life-giving ideals that will give me the kind of life that I can look back on in 1 year or 50 years and say, you know, if I only had one shot at this, I'm glad this is how I lived it. That's what we're looking for. That's the center of any honest religion. Now, this is timeless. You find this in the Gilgamesh story 4,700 years ago. You find this everywhere that people are taking themselves and their life seriously and have the courage to ask tough questions and the courage to transform their lives. This timeless quality, I'll prove this to you. I'll prove this to you right here and now. This thing, this timeless quality of this style, this orientation, is what's behind the experience so many visitors to churches like this have. People will come into a church like this and they'll say, my God, this feels like home. I didn't know there was a place like this. I've been looking for this all my life. I've always thought these things. I didn't know there were mobs of people that got together and thought this way. My head and my heart are home here. Well, what's that thing that they're describing? It is not Unitarian Universalism. That was only put together as a religion in the 1980s. I remember when they did it, and I didn't like it. It's not Unitarianism. That only goes back 200 years in our country, only 500 years altogether. It's a whole lot older than that. It's not Christianity that people are responding to. It isn't theism. It is something primal. It is something primal in the human soul that wants honesty, truth, life, love, healing, wholeness, those things. That's the religious impulse. It's the manger from which all of our gods were born and all of our religions were born. Now, it's so broad that obviously you can find it in places other than religion. Churches certainly don't have a corner on this market. Some would say they aren't even in the market. I'll tell you where I found it recently. Some of you have read this. I just finished reading a trilogy called His Dark Materials by Philip Pullman, the British writer who wrote these teen fantasies for an audience of young people between, I don't know, maybe the ages of 10 to 18 or so. How many have read these things? How many know these things? Some of your kids do, too. I know I have a colleague, a Unitarian minister. I told him this week, and he said, oh, God. He said, that's what made my son say he was through with all religion forever. When the first volume of this trilogy, The Golden Compass, was made into a very high-budget movie last year with Nicole Kidman playing the sociopath and doing it really well, she was really scary, and I didn't know she could do scary that well. She did scary very well. When it came out, some evangelical groups attacked it and attacked Pullman because he's an atheist. And I thought, well, that's what they're always saying. I don't care much about that stuff. Then when I read the books, I thought, my God, they understated it. He's so much more subtle. He never bothers saying, I'm an atheist and I hate God. That's nowhere in there. It's much more creative, much broader, much deeper, much more devastating. He really takes on every aspect of authoritarian religions and decimates them, including the reward they offer, heaven. He makes heaven look like a miserable thing where people with no bodies who can't hug, can't love, go wishing, as Achilles did in the ancient Greek myths, that they could just be a stable hand in the real world because it's better than being a king of heaven. And so in the book, one of the things he does is release all these poor souls from heaven so that their atoms can dissipate back into the universe and they can become part of light and life and flowers and air again. And just before they dissipate, they have a look of pure joy on their face. This is powerful stuff. This is a religious thinker taking apart the dominant religion of Western civilization and doing it in a way that 12 and 13-year-old kids can understand very deeply. It should plant the seeds of a healthy skepticism in them in the name of a religion of honesty and empowerment. That's what honest religion's about. It's revolutionary. Now, this garden where that spirit grows is the garden where the spirit of this William Ellery Channing guy grew. To be fair, his vision was not as deep or broad or ambitious as that of Philip Pullman. But Philip Pullman had the advantage of writing 150 years later, too, and being able to publish these books without being burned at the stake for them. And that helps. Channing was also no revolutionary. He disliked controversy, although he was drawn into a lot of it because he was such a brilliant preacher and writer. And he was brilliant. He graduated from Harvard at the top of his class at the age of 18 in 1798. In the early 1800s, he was regarded as the best preacher in America. He was one of the people interviewed by Alexis de Tocqueville for his work on his classic book, Democracy in America. Channing was not a pioneer, and he would be the first to say that. He followed several generations of American Congregationalist ministers, and he was a Congregationalist, who taught that Jesus was just a human, that we all had a likeness to God, and that the creeds and rigid beliefs of the church distracted us from the deeper message that was concerned with changing our lives and empowering us here and now. Channing came at the end of 60 or 80 years of this kind of preaching he'd heard and was aware of. And Channing, no less than the Trinitarian Christians, had a trinity. But it was that trinity of honest religion, that Trojan horse, subversive, revolutionary, wonderful trinity. The wonderful thing is a word that you probably would hear in a liberal church, but not in a conservative church. About that trinity. He had faith first in our dignity rather than our damnation. And that faith in our inherent goodness rather than a crippling sinfulness is at the heart of the impulse toward honest religion in all times and places. He trusted reason. He was a child of the Enlightenment. He trusted reason. And he exalted it above scriptures and religious teachings in some ways. But he did it in ways that we all have to do. He said that if we couldn't trust reason, now think about this, if we couldn't trust reason, then we also couldn't trust the reason of those who are trying to tell us what's true. That's how they got there. We have that too. Not only that, we have our lives that we're trying to fit this stuff into. We're way ahead of them. We need to trust our experience, our lives, our reason, and our intuition. Here are some of his words on this, so you can hear. how radical he was. And you can also feel that this is a voice coming from way beyond Christianity, way beyond theism. This is a voice that Gilgamesh could have recognized. Hear Channing's words. It's always best to think first for ourselves on any subject, and then to look to others for the correction or improvement of our own sentiments. The quantity of knowledge thus gained may be less, but the quality will be superior. Truth received on authority or acquired without labor makes but a feeble impression. Our leading principle in interpreting Scripture is this, that the Bible is a book written for men in the language of men, and that its meaning is to be sought in the same manner as that of other books. Now, there's a religious revolution right there, just in those two statements, in any tradition. And we therefore distrust every interpretation which, after deliberate attention, seems repugnant to any established truth. There is a human spirit yearning toward a freedom that it will let nothing stop it from. Wonderful. He objected to the Christian Trinity, both because it was irrational and because it never appeared in the Bible, and it doesn't. Like Jesus, he said, he worshipped only God. He also found irrational and insulting the idea that Jesus came to save us from God's wrath, or that his death would somehow change God's mind. No, he said, Jesus didn't come to change God's mind. Think what a juvenile concept of God that involves. Jesus came to change our minds, he said. This is good theology. He granted that reason can be used badly in religion, as in all other areas, but then he asked people to look back through history and decide whether more harm has been done by trusting reason or by forbidding it. That's an easy one. So far, these two can destroy every orthodoxy in human history. Religious, political, social, every orthodoxy in human history can be destroyed by the willingness to trust our life, our experience, our reason, our feeling, and to trust the kind of integrity that they can have and can guide us toward. The third part of his Trinity was God, but even here he meant something very different from Orthodox Christians. Here are some of his words. You can hear the spirit of honest and timeless religion coming through, and you can hear that he's talking about something more primal than any God. See if you don't hear this. We cannot bow before a being, however great and powerful, who governs tyrannically. We respect nothing but excellence, whether on earth or in heaven. We venerate not the loftiness of God's throne, but the equity and goodness in which it is established. By these remarks, we do not mean to deny the importance of God's aid or spirit, but by his spirit, we mean a moral, illuminating, and persuasive influence, not physical, not compulsory. You're beyond Christianity, you're beyond the Bible, you're beyond theism. You're in the realm of this spirit of life with words like this. That's what made him good. He spoke of his zeal for truth, but he didn't think it showed up very often in religion. And he wrote that on no subject have people injected so many strange conceits, wild theories, and fictions of fancy as on religion. The kind of truth he sought was what he called purifying truth that could make us more godlike. He also said, in my view, religion is another name for happiness, and I am most cheerful when I am most religious. That's nice stuff. He's not speaking as a Unitarian here or as a liberal Christian. He is speaking from some place almost beyond time, because that voice could come from anywhere, and it would sound the same. Now, was Channing a Unitarian? I think that's very hard to answer. He called his sermon Unitarian Christianity. Although it contained ideas whose logical implications would lead beyond Unitarianism, Christianity, theism, and the Bible. That's the sermon he delivered in 1819 that all students for the UU ministry have to read. And he later wrote other pieces defending his Unitarian Christianity against the Orthodox churches, saying it was more honest and it helped form people of better character. But what he meant was that this method of honoring reason and experience, examining everything carefully, discarding what doesn't hold up, including creeds, orthodoxies, and holding fast only to what is good, that is better than orthodox alternatives and creates people of better character. And then, when the American Unitarian Association first began in 1825, he would not join it. He never supported it. He thought that people should seek to develop themselves within local churches, but that an organization like the Unitarian Association would probably just be, as he put it, an agent of unneeded mischief. I like him. He said there is no moral worth in being swept away by a crowd, even toward the best objects. An established church, he said, is the grave of intellect. This is an ancient voice. This could speak from any religion and be opening the windows to just as much light as he was doing in 1819. When he used the word God, it meant excellence that made rational and moral sense. Who doesn't agree with that? Now, to put it in his language, he believed we were created in the image of God, that God gave us reason and expected us to use it, and that any faith that denied this or that could not stand up to the critiques of informed reason was unworthy of us and unworthy of God. In the language of our time, though, he was very close to what we would call a religious humanist, as all varieties of liberal religion through the ages have been. That's another sermon. I've always identified with a lot about Channing, including his deep distrust and rejection of any national organization that was bound to become a kind of club, offering a kind of second-hand religion and club membership at the expense of being the death of intellect. But I like him mostly because he was one of those people whose vision transcended the beliefs of his time and place and his clergy colleagues and the people around him. And it caught a glimpse of the kind of honest religion that really does seem to be timeless and really seems to be life-giving in all times and places. And that's a glimpse of what is sacred. The insights of honest religion transcend all the gods and religions, not because we're bigger than the gods, but because life is. And it's life's longing for itself that comes alive in us and drives us to examine everything carefully and hold fast only to what is good. Now, if you've never heard of this preacher from the early 19th century, and you wonder if you should be writing his name down because there may be a test, don't worry about it. You don't have to care about William Ellery Channing. And while we're at it, and in the same key, you don't have to care about Jesus or the Buddha. Religion isn't about the gods, the teachers, or the preachers, no matter how many of them think it is. The best of them are all windows opening us to visions of life so honest, so big, that they might beckon to us, might lure us into following them down a richer path. They're like rainbows, to use one metaphor, suggesting that if we would follow them, there could be a pot of gold at the end. Or in another metaphor, they're like recipes, saying that if we can add our ingredients, figure out the missing instructions, and imagine how to cook them up right, they could help us make a better life. It shouldn't be so hard. There are those three steps. At least they don't change much. First, we must bring our life and our experiences, the happy ones, the proud ones, the raw ones, the bad ones, the ones we're ashamed of, the ones where we went off the path, the ones where we were brilliant, all of them. That's the stuff we need to wrap into our life. Then we need to trust our honest reason and intuition. We can't try to kid ourselves, because in that game, no matter who wins, we lose. And then there's the center. What are we tuned to? What will we serve? Where's the center around which we want to be in a kind of orbit, the kind of center that gives us a calling and an integrity that keep life from becoming just one damned thing after another? Now, we'll end here before it's cooked, this recipe, because finishing it is our job in our own lives. And so we'll leave here today half-baked. We leave carrying some of our parts in bags or buckets, still unassembled. But we kind of know where they should go, how they need to be put together to make a whole being, a whole life. Wouldn't it be nice to be that, a whole being? The essential parts put together with integrity and feeling, serving a center that gives us life, learning how to walk, dance, maybe even sing. That wild, enticing, nearly impossible feeling task is what we're always about in the pursuit of honest religion. There are no secrets. We have good materials to work with. They're us. And it can be done step by step by step. But it can't be done in just one week. That's why we meet like this every Sunday.